Why is a scientist with no ties to the United States at all credited with founding one of America's great institutions?
Well, that's always been one of the big questions, because Smithson never came to the United States.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll explore the science of James Smithson, founder of the Smithsonian. We'll also meet an unlikely scholar and spend an academic minute with the political swan song of the baby boomers. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Smithsonian Institution is the world's largest museum, education, and research complex. It is a beloved part of American culture, but its founder, a British scientist named James Smithson, never once set foot on American soil. So, who would do that? Stephen Turner tried to find out. Turner is the author of the new book, The Science of James Smithson, Discoveries from the Smithsonian Founder. While researching Smithson's science, he also learned a lot about Smithson's personality. Stephen Turner is an historian of science and curator emeritus of physical sciences at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. I asked how he took on this project.
Well, I actually got inspired. About 15 years ago, I had a meeting with a young scholar named Heather Ewing, who was writing a new biography of James Smithson, the founder of the Smithsonian. And she found a lot of new material about Smithson, his personality and his travels and that sort of thing, but she was having trouble understanding his science. And since I'm a science history specialist, she came to talk to me about it. And like most people, I had basically dismissed Smithson as sort of a marginal figure, kind of an amateur, not really very accomplished. But Heather encouraged me to take another look at his work, and as I began to read his articles, I realized there was a lot more there than I had realized. And so I spent some time working on Smithson science, and I like to think that I helped Heather with her book, which turned out very well. It's called The Lost World of James Smithson. And it's an excellent work, but I always felt that there was more to Smithson science than we'd been able to get at that time. And so this became my new hobby. I began replicating Smithson's experiments at home and learning about his interests in his life. And this went on for several years until about 7 years ago, I realized I had enough material to write a book about Smithson science. So that's what I did, and that's what led me to be on your show.
What was it that kept Smithson science so hidden all these years?
Well, that's an excellent question, because he had a good reputation while he was alive. He's well known in England and France and considered to really be a top guy. But the story that seems to emerge is that he had a falling out with people in the Royal Society. That, without going into too many details, he sort of overstepped his bounds and had an article published that was thought not to be appropriate for the Royal Society. So Smithson was kind of ostracized from English science. And in his early 50s, he actually left England, moved to Paris, and sort of started another life. He left behind his associations with English scientific societies and became kind of an isolated figure in Paris, although he knew a lot of famous people. And so I think that's what really led to his falling out of history, was his lack of any association with, at least in the later part of his life, with English scientific societies or any kind of formal science at that time.
And later on, many of his papers were destroyed in a fire, right?
That's one of the sad truths about Smithson's life. Yeah, and when his estate came to the United States, was 12 years after he died in 1838, it includes not only money, but his clothes, his books, his scientific instrument collection, his mineral collection, then about 200 unpublished papers that he'd written on a number of different topics. And sadly, these were in the Smithsonian Castle in 1865 when it was destroyed in a horrendous fire. So, as we say in the history business, that's what gives jobs to historians. So that's what I've taken on in this project.
And what was his relationship with the United States so that his estate ended up here?
Well, that's always been one of the big questions, because Smithson never came to the United States. He corresponded with a few people here in the States, but he spent his whole life in England and on the continent. And so why would he leave what at that time was worth about $500,000? Why would he leave a fortune that size to the United States, a place he'd never visited? And even more so, why did he fail to give instructions as to what specifically was supposed to be done with the money? The only thing that he put in his will was that it was supposed to be used to found an institution named the Smithsonian, to be headquartered in Washington, D.C., and to be dedicated to the increase and diffusion of knowledge. And this wasn't a question that I'd really intended to address in a book about Smithson science, but as it turned out, I was able to find some insights into this. And what I found was that the phrase increase and diffusion of knowledge that Smithson used in his will, when he wrote his will in 1828, that was a political catchphrase for the workers' education movement. This was big in Scotland and England at the time, and Smithson, being a liberal, and this being a liberal cause, he was deeply interested in worker education and improving the lot of working class people. And so like I say, this phrase, increase in diffusion of knowledge, became a political catchphrase for them. And when he wrote his will, everyone in England would have known, would have understood this. But by the time his will came to the United States 12 years later, the situation had changed. Worker education was being addressed in the U.S. It was not seen to be a problem that needed to be solved, and so Smithson's money was used to build in a sort of put together a general institution, a cultural icon, rather than something dedicated specifically to workers.
You point out in the book that will was pretty much a gamble, sending that money over here and hoping for the best. And Smithson,
right.
Smithson was a gambler, wasn't he?
He was. That always surprises people, and it surprised me the first time I heard it. But yeah, the last 10 years of his life, he was in very poor health. He really suffered from arthritis and dental problems and possibly other problems. He complained about not being able to sleep, not being able to eat. He became kind of reclusive, and the only thing that would calm him down and allow him to get some sleep was to gamble. And so late at night, he would go to these gambling parlors and wager quite large sums of money, as it turned out. But it was all just to sort of distract himself from the physical pain he was in.
Well, he had the money, so there was that.
he definitely did.
Yes.
And he was smart about his money. He increased it over his lifetime.
Well, I want to go back to the science, which, of course, is why you wrote the book in the first place. When he first got into Oxford, chemistry was his interest, wasn't it?
It was. It was very, very much his specialty. And chemistry was really the thread that holds his science together. He applied it to other topics, but chemistry was always his main specialty.
And he got into Oxford at what turned out to be the right time for someone interested in chemistry, because you say things changed in the chemistry department there right about when he got there.
Yes. Oxford was actually sort of rejuvenated in terms of its science education right around the same time that Smithson started there. And Smithson had gotten a head start on this anyway, because he lived in London. He started Oxford when he was, I think, he was 17, I believe. But he had been studying chemistry independently in London. There was a private chemistry school in Soho, London, that was very important. And it seems that his father attended this school as well. Chemistry was seen as something the educated men should know about because of its practical importance. And I think that Smithson probably attended this chemistry school before he went to Oxford, so that by the time he went to Oxford, he was already an accomplished chemist and very far ahead of his other classmates.
We should point out, too, that you mentioned Smithson's father. He didn't really know his father, did he?
Well, that had always been the big question, whether they had actually even met. Smithson was illegitimate, and his father was probably the wealthiest man in England, so he was really socially elite. And the question of whether he never acknowledged Smithson as being his son, but they seem to have had a relationship centered around chemistry. Smithson acknowledged this in one of the unpublished footnotes to one of his articles. He said that his father had inspired his interest in chemistry. So it's nice that they at least had that kind of a relationship.
When you went about to recreate Smithson's experiments, were mm-hmm. you trying to get insight into the work or the person?
Well, I'm not sure that you can really separate those two, but the reason I did the experiments was primarily to try to get at what was in Smithson's science, because his articles are famously difficult to understand. His writing style was very terse, and he described things that really don't seem familiar to a modern reader. For example, in his article on calamine, the zinc ore that was named Smithsonite in honor of Smithson, Smithson describes an experiment in that article, and he does it in a single paragraph. He had a sample of this mineral, and he heated it. He said, I applied the blue flame to it. And then he said, the mineral effervesced and produced flowers on the charcoal. So the blue flame, flowers and on the charcoal. Is this poetry? What is Smithson saying? But as I got into it, I realized that he's describing what he saw in this experiment. The blue flame means that he was using a blowpipe. The blowpipe is a small bent metal tube that allows you to blow through a flame, like a candle or an oil lamp flame, and generate a considerable amount of heat. And as you blow through this flame, it produces a long blue flame that comes off the sides. And so this was clearly what Smithson saw as he starts this experiment. And then he talks about the zinc producing flowers. Well, that turns out to have been the name that everyone used at the time for what happened when you heated zinc, because it would vaporize. It has a very low vaporization point. And it would immediately bond with oxygen in the air and sort of redeposit itself on the sample in the form of this white powder that was called flowers. And then when they talk about the blue flame forming flowers on the coal was actually a piece of coal that Smithson was using to hold the sample so he didn't burn his hands. So even though it sounded philosophical or poetic, this is a very matter-of-fact description of what Smithson was seeing.
What was his, I'm not going to say obsession, but his extreme interest in crayons?
That was towards the end of his life. Actually, crayon was the word that was used in Smithson's time for pastels. And so he had a pastel portrait that he wanted to take from London to Paris, but he was afraid of damaging it, and he didn't want to try to transport it in a big frame with a piece of glass. One of his last articles is describing his efforts to stabilize this so-called painting with oils and other things so that he could travel with it. It's interesting that the pastels were really preferred over any other medium for portraits at this time. And so this was a sort of widespread problem, was how to transport these things because they were so terribly fragile. So in spite of the fact that it sounds like Smithson was addressing a very esoteric topic, this was actually something of considerable interest at the time.
Still to come, our conversation with Stephen Turner continues with a look at how Smithson was seen by his scientific peers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. And our guest today is Stephen Turner, author of the new book, The Science of James Smithson, Discoveries from the Smithsonian Founder. Stephen Turner is an historian of science and curator emeritus of physical sciences at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. I asked him about Smithson's relationship with other scientists at the time. Was he respected or tolerated, or was he just that Smithson guy?
No, actually, he was a scientific insider, at least in the first part of his life. When he graduated from Oxford and moved to London, it was just a couple years before he became a member of the Royal Society, which is the premier scientific society in England. And he was actually the youngest person ever elected at that time. So there's people, even from an early time, they saw Smithson as a promising young man and a future leader of scientific England. And that's the way it pretty much worked out. His first articles were great successes. One was called Tabashir, one was Calamine, which we already talked about. Really important works that gave Smithson a strong reputation. And that reputation lasted in one form or another for most of his life. But unfortunately, in his early 50s, Smithson's health problems really started to be a problem for him. And he ended up moving to Paris and lived in Paris the rest of his life, which has sort of removed him from the English scientific society and really kind of isolated him. So it part of the reason that his reputation today isn't as strong as it probably should be was because of his lack of connections at that time.
Is much, or any for that matter, of his work displayed or honored in some way at the institution?
Well, that's something that we're hoping to do more of. Smithson's body now lies in the crypt over at the Smithsonian Castle, right on the Mall, and there are some small objects there related to Smithson's scientific interests. But now that my book is finally finished, we're looking forward to doing some websites and possibly an exhibit and try to make some of these things better known.
Do you think in the end that he ever dreamed that his donation would turn into what it did?
I'm sorry there was no way for him to know how successful it was going to be. It was a huge gamble on his part to just give his money to the United States that way. But it worked out spectacularly well. And it fits in with, you know, Smithson's sort of reputation as being a gambler, because what could have been a bigger gamble than that?
One more thing, I do have a note right here. I did read the chapter about when he developed the test for arsenic and mercury. Mm-hmm. Is the test for mercury his longest lasting contribution?
I think it was. Yeah, and that was remarkable, because when in 1879 the Smithsonian decided to make the first investigation into Smithson science, and they were looking for some important discovery or invention that he'd made to enhance the Smithsonian institution by enhancing the reputation of its founder. But even though Smithson's test was being used at that time in the United States and was called Smithson's test, no one thought it was the Smithson that had founded the institution. And so it was just ignored. It's kind of remarkable, but this is how things drop out of history.
Stephen Turner is an historian of science and curator emeritus of physical sciences at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. His new book is called The Science of James Smithson, Discoveries from the Smithsonian Founder. It's published by Smithsonian Books. people sometimes take unlikely paths before finding where they need to go in life. That's the story of this unlikely scholar, a poor student who didn't learn how to read until he was in fifth grade. From KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media in Seattle, Tori Zivkovich has his story.
I'm sorry, I didn't know.
It's okay, I'm looking for Leo Morales.
Yeah,
knock, knock.
Hey,
are you Leo?
How are you?
Good. It
Good
took
to
me.
See you.
I was looking for Leo because I had heard about his research. Can you tell me basically what you do on a daily basis?
Oh, wow. What I do would sound very boring. I go to meetings. I talk to people.
Even though he says that, Leo S. Morales loves his job,
proposals.
Which I can't emphasize enough. He works for the University of Washington, researching minority health. As he talks, he leans forward, a short, gray-haired man in his 50s.
I mean, I found out I have a talent for and interest in research. What I found out is it's not that hard to create new knowledge if you have some tools.
But those tools were not so easily gained. They have taken Leo a lifetime. He was born here, but his parents were from Bolivia.
My father came first. He came actually out of high school.
Leo grew up in Seattle, only speaking Spanish, leaving him isolated when he started kindergarten, where he struggled to learn English alongside his mother. He didn't learn to read until fifth grade when he...
spent a summer reading comic books because I couldn't read. So it just took time. It was learning another language. It was hard, but I just, that's what I had to do, and so that's what I did.
School was more interesting after that. Then, one day, a friend from middle school told him he was going to go to Seattle Prep, a private school, instead of the local public high school.
I thought that was kind of a cool idea.
But his mother couldn't afford private school. By then, she was divorced and going to college herself. Then, he got a break. Seattle Prep accepted him on a scholarship. It was here this curiosity really took off. Can you remember a project or anything that you did that really stands out?
I needed to do a report, and so I went and learned how a sewage treatment plant works. It smelled really bad. That was not the cool part.
It was disgusting down in the sewers, but they fascinated him.
Well, I just wondered how that actually all worked. So it was pretty neat.
He realized then that the world was full of mysteries waiting for him to solve. But it didn't last. The mystery lost its glamour during his first 2 years at the University of Washington.
So I think the first 2 years were probably the hardest when you're going through the general courses. You know, just it's kind of boring parts of it. It's just kind of like doing stuff you have to do to get through, but it's not really all that interesting.
He thought about dropping out.
You know, I spent a summer working in a warehouse.
Leo walked through the warehouse, climbing racks and pulling people's orders.
First, it seemed kind of cool.
But it quickly grew tiresome.
Then really thought about whether I wanted to be in college. A summer in a warehouse taught me I want to be in college. So
he gave college a second chance. This time around, he found his path.
I focused on chemistry, and I really enjoyed it. With the thought of being a scientist, that's how I was led to healthcare. For me, it was a very natural extension to be interested in immigrant health.
From here, it was the next logical step when his research led him to the Latino health paradox. The paradox is based on data showing Latino immigrants live surprisingly long and healthy lives in the United States, despite often having low income and limited access to health care. Leo's family fit right into the paradox. He was curious and wanted to learn more, but it was not easy.
There are the realities of staying funded if you're a researcher, so that can be stressful.
Leo and some colleagues applied for a massive grant to study the paradox. It took them 3 months to write it. It was immediately rejected.
In fact, failures are really opportunities for learning. And that sounds cliche, but it's really, really true.
They rewrote the grant. This time, it worked.
This whole process is like chipping away at a bigger problem. And, you know, I saw that as work that was really helpful. I have focused on minority health. Minority communities have tended to be underserved and under-researched.
He knows how fortunate he is to be where he is today.
Just, this is the best, right? I'm getting paid to, like, find out some interesting stuff. You know, I was a curious person. I wanted to do this work, and I'm getting paid to do it. And I thought that was pretty incredible. You know, it's very privileged. You know, it's very, very fortunate.
Now he wants to give others the same chances he had.
And that's a really great thing. Young people who you know, may not have had all the opportunities coming along. And so well, I guess I can do this. This is kind of cool.
To do that, he started pipeline programs that will open doors for future students. From Radioactive, this is The Story by Tori.
Tori Zivkovich produced that story through KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media in Seattle. You can learn more at kuow.org/radioactive. Now that this year's presidential election has finally passed us, was this the political swan song of the baby boomer generation? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
A generational swing could change the outcome of the 2020 election. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, discusses why.
The 2020 U.S. elections are important for many reasons. Among them, this will be the first in more than 30 years where baby boomers are not the largest generational voting bloc. It is the beginning of the end of the political era for the baby boom generation. Generations drive political change in two stages. Each new generation is socialized in its adolescence to think about the world, including politics, in a unique way. They experience common events such as wars, economic changes, or major cultural landmarks, imprinting their political beliefs for life. As adults in their 30s and 40s, they are in a position to act on those beliefs and begin to remake the world in their own generational image. The baby boomers were no different. Born after World War II and up to about 1960, these 77 million individuals came of age during the Cold and Vietnam Wars. Richard Nixon in Watergate, the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, Neil Armstrong on the moon. They changed American views on sex, marriage, civil rights, women's rights, and gay rights. They were inspired by Rachel Carson and Earth Day to enact environmental legislation. They elected Bill Clinton and George Bush as their own, and as they aged, they pushed for health care reform. For some, the baby boomer era of politics brought needed change. For others, it is good riddance and time for a new generation to take over. With the 2020 election, the political torch passes not to Gen X, the small generation born after them, but to the millennials and Gen Z. They are the most populous and racially ethnic diverse generations in history. How politics will change as a result of them is just beginning to be seen. But there is no question that while the baby boomers had a major political impact, their era is just ending.
That was David Schultz of Hamline University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.